Longtime readers of Medusa in English, not just longtime readers, but readers who really follow everything we publish, know that we briefly had a dedicated opinion section where we commissioned essays and had original little illustrations for our authors. We published some great stuff, though none of the authors were very happy with the cartoons we made. But it was also very difficult work that became even more challenging and ideologically fraught when Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine and plunged the West into a new discourse on Russia that narrowed the space for acceptable debate. The Moscow Times has published op-eds for decades, and its opinions desk remains a platform for some of the field's best and brightest. To talk about that work, I'm joined today by the opinion editor of the Moscow Times, Charlie Hancock. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Medusa in English. Welcome back to the show, and welcome to this week's interview with Moscow Times opinion editor, Charlie Hancock. As I said in my introduction, I've had some experience at Medusa with our opinion section, and I found it to be very hard stuff. I began my conversation with Charlie by asking how she got into this work.
So I'm from a military background.
Okay.
My dad was in the Royal Air Force. And when you grow up with that, geopolitics is always in the room. Even when you're too young to really understand what's going on, there's always a question of, where is my dad going to be next month? What's he going to be doing? Why is he doing that? Is he safe? He wasn't a Russia specialist, but a lot of his work was connected to Russia in some ways, whether that be involved in the quick reaction alerts in the Baltic states or air policing activities chasing Tupolev's 95s out from over the North Sea. Russia was always in the room with me. And I started learning the language when I was 13, thanks to a language teacher at my high school who just happened to be from Russia. And that from there became, I think a lot of us get interested in Russia for similar reasons. That being the history, it being incredibly tumultuous. So many historical and political ideas have been tested through Russia. And then you also have the literature and the music and the interesting little facets of the language, which are so absorbing. And I knew I wanted to be a journalist, but I didn't necessarily know precisely what I wanted to write about. Whatever question I have about Russia, I can message an expert and ask them to write something for me about it. The very nature of the editing process requires very close reading and fact-checking. So you absorb huge amounts of information through it.
What's one of the subjects or questions that's been kind of the most unexpected journey for you in that work?
Unexpected?
Nuclear policy, or is there some area where when you're talking to friends, let's say, who aren't in the field?
Nuclear policy, I'd say, is one of them. I suppose the Russian judicial system and how it's different. We occasionally get stories in more generalist press about particular political prisoners, but people wouldn't necessarily be aware. They will hear, for example, about, in the quote, international LGBTQ plus movement having been declared an extremist movement. And that a lot of people might assume that that means that you're going to be thrown in prison for that. Well, the cases of people having been prosecuted under that law, they're administrative fines. And if you translate it into dollars, they're not huge amounts of money. That doesn't mean that it isn't serious.
Right.
But I think that a lot of people read the headlines when it comes to Russia. And it can still have a chilling effect, what goes on. But they don't actually know how that works on the ground.
What are some of the debates that you find yourself moderating or mediating as opinions desk editor at the Moscow Times? I know that, just recently, if you visit the website, you'll see, even just by glancing at the headlines, at the titles of the essays, you'll see the debates that kind of stand out. One of the ones that I noticed a second ago before we started speaking was work by prominent liberal oppositionists. I think Ilya Yashin was among them. And then, for instance, there's an essay by a indigenous activist from Russia accusing the Russian liberal opposition of basically ignoring them and, like, you know, promoting like a ethnic or racial sort of vision of Russia that excludes them. So that seems to be one kind of debate that you are giving space to in the opinions desk. What are some other debates that you moderate?
Economics. That's often one of our most popular topics, not just in the opinion section, but in the business section, about where there are cracks forming in the Russian economy and the implications of that for the war effort, but also where it's more stable than a lot of people would imagine, and whether actually some of those cracks might have been based on isolated reports or information coming out of Russia, which even the Russian media who play by the rules might have exaggerated slightly, giving us a false impression. We ran an op-ed recently challenging the perception that there had in fact been a gas crisis, gas being petrol for my British
gasoline
compatriots going on. So economics is a big one, and there's clearly huge appetite for it among our readers. The opposition is another very interesting one, and also the status of Russians within Europe. We've had op-eds both from people who are encouraging greater restrictions on their ability to get visas to move around, and also people who are saying that this kind of collective punishment is uncalled for, and perhaps we should leave a window available for Russians to be exposed to Europe and European values. But then we'll also people saying, look, they're coming over and having a nice time and then going back to their home country.
Mm-hmm. When you're commissioning pieces or when you're copy editing something you've received, how cognizant are you of the polemics of the piece? And because, I mean, even like when you talk about everything you just mentioned, it takes me an instant to know where it falls in like today's polemics. It's like, okay, if a story says that the gas crisis is exaggerated, you'll have hordes of people saying this is Russian propaganda because obviously their gas industry is collapsing. If you have anybody saying that there is a true crisis, you'll have people saying, oh, this is just, you know, Western propaganda because obviously things are fine. And so,
yeah, how many security agencies have you been accused of working for?
Right. All of them. But
all of them, and somehow all of the ones that oppose each other.
Sure. And so do you, like, have you at this point, do you just kind of wave that away and you're like, I've had enough? That's kind of where I feel, honestly. But it's on some level, you still need to engage it because these are your readers to some degree. And you know, the concerns are not completely, you know, illegitimate, I guess. And so, like, how do you, at this point in the game, where's your head at?
I have a thick skin. And generally, if somebody accuses the Moscow Times of being a propagandist either way, they're not actually making specific critiques of the author's argument. If somebody is going to make specific critiques about what somebody has written, then I actually welcome them writing an op-ed in response. But it's quite rare that people actually do that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. How do you deal with writers who may be like personally exposed to Russian state repression? Like, this is an issue that I think all the exiled media has, is that it's become much harder to access, you know, views and opinions from, I mean, or just like, you know, reporting for that matter. Anybody's content created by people in Russia is now, for organizations like the Moscow Times or Medusa for that matter, you know, because we're, you know, undesirable in Russia. And how do you deal with that kind of stuff?
Obviously, there are sensitivities in what I can say about this.
Sure.
It is possible for us to publish op-eds from people within Russia. But since the designation, there have been many fewer inquiries about that. So the majority of the people we talk to would be those within the diaspora. Or ideally, now some of my dream op-eds are from people who have direct experience of working within state apparatus, but who have since left the country.
And do you worry that, like, you're, by having access basically limited to people who are either willing to break the law anonymously or who have, like, fled and become dissidents, especially in an opinion context, that the field of opinions has narrowed outside your own choices, obviously. Like, you know, there will be views that you don't want to platform, but what's available, it has like restricted.
I think that applies to sources.
Yeah.
Reporting too.
Definitely.
And when people ask me what the Moscow Times tries to do, what I usually say is, well, we have a Russian service and an English service. Our Russian service is about getting accurate news to both the diaspora and people within Russia whom we still can reach. The English service is about explaining Russia and what goes on to an international audience, but without trying to squeeze that news into a Western frame of thinking,
okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay. Folks, pardon the interruption, but I just wanted to remind listeners that I write a daily newsletter for Medusa. Subscribe and get a brief summary of the day's Russia-related news stories. And also with each message, I look at something interesting in this corner of the world, whether it's a recent research paper, an investigative report, an interview, who knows? I play fast and loose with my selection criteria, so subscribe and find out what tomorrow's edition will bring. Visit Medusa's homepage and sign up.
I sometimes notice when reading op-eds in more generalist mainstream media by foreign affairs commentators, not necessarily Russian experts, that they will raise particular events in a way that either sensationalizes, exaggerates, or is just divorced from the actual context of what goes on there. And I think there's an awful lot of this to do with Russian strategic behavior. Even I'm actually doing an international relations and war studies master's on the side where I'm working, and quite often you will read an analysis that is overly based in theory and positions Russia as being very reactive to external stimuli. Of course, Russia will react to some things, but that completely overlooks internal processes and motivations, and also Russia's own sense of its history and its behavior. You don't have to endorse that in order to write with that knowledge. But if you want to actually give people an understanding of what is happening and allow them to perhaps anticipate future events, then that is essential.
So what are some red flags that readers should look out for if it turns out they're reading something like you just described?
Good question.
I mean, you kind of answered this maybe a bit, as you were saying that if they don't touch on the local context enough. But does that mean that are you looking out for, like, I suppose in some level I do this, it's like if someone's written something about Russia, I'll give it a quick glance and see, like, are they mentioning individuals beyond, other than like Putin? You know, like that often.
Yeah,
that's
a big one. I will often judge the quality of a bookshop by what percentage of its books about Russia are books about Putin specifically.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a big one, I suppose.
I think also, on the one hand, Russian provocations against Europe are certainly noteworthy, but there's a genre of op-ed which is incredibly simplistic. They ignore that what we call Russian hybrid warfare is actually Russia's deterrence strategies. They actually use the phrase hybrid warfare to refer to their interpretation of a lot of Western actions.
Right.
I think there are some examples, and this isn't so much an op-ed, but it's in international communication about this. Mark Rutte's recent comments about how Europe should prepare for the kind of war that our grandparents will have known.
We are Russia's next target. And we are already in harm's way. Russia has brought war back to Europe. And we must be prepared for the scale of war our grandparents and great-grandparents endured.
Well, where I'm sitting right now, in the Netherlands, that is occupation and the deportation and murder of a significant portion of the population. Where I'm from, in the UK, that'll be our major cities being bombed. There are certainly military threats ongoing. However, those two scenarios are incredibly unlikely. But then also a couple of months ago, when I asked Mark Rutte a question, he responded by saying, well, we shouldn't take Russia too seriously. their pilots aren't very good at flying in straight lines, in reference to the Russian aircraft intercepted over Estonia. And, well, he's clearly trying to do two things at once and not articulating either of them properly. One of them is to wake up a continent that has been asleep about its own security. And the other is to make it so that the threat from Russia doesn't appear to be so enormous that it's futile to try and rearm against it.
Okay.
Or when it comes to other analysis of the war, you'd have people writing, this one weapon will change the game for Ukraine on the ground, which is not how warfare works.
When commissioning work for the opinion page, are there necessary sort of provocations? This is maybe, I imagine this question is slightly different as to what debates are you curating. This is more, are there like specific provocations of readers that you seek out, maybe along the lines of, you know, you're reviewing comments by someone like Mark, and you decide that he's failing in some attempt at some kind of, you know, influencing public opinion and so on. Were you tracking news and you'll decide for yourself, like, I want to provoke readers with this. I think like there's like a provocative argument to be made, and you'll seek out someone to make it. Is that part of the workflow, or do you think of your job as like necessary provocations, or is that not enter into it?
It's a combination of the two.
Okay.
And I'd maybe question the word provocation, because I'd like what I published to have more substance behind it than just trying to get a reaction. If I think there is a question to be asked about something, I will try and seek out somebody to answer that question. Similarly, I am open to op-ed commissions, arguing all kinds of things, provided they are well backed up.
Mm-hmm.
But people with some views are much more likely to submit a pitch in the first place.
Right, right. I saw that just yesterday, the EU imposed sanctions on a series, I think it was like 4 or 5 Russian social scientists, and some of them were like, it was like Fyodor Lukyanov, Dmitry Suslov, Ivan Timofeyev, and maybe an organization or two. I don't have the list in front of me right now, but they're subject to sanctions or something like this. I don't know if it was freezing accounts, or probably more than anything, just singling them out for not being allowed to come is my guess. But at any rate, the grounds, as I understand them, are largely based on like just what they write. Not that they've committed crimes per se, but that they're amplifying Kremlin propaganda, facilitating disinformation, stuff like that. Essentially, the allegation is, I suppose, that they're lying and that they're in cahoots with the regime. But ultimately, it's like, you wrote bad stuff. Like, that's the kind of like claim. And so I wonder, Lukyanov, I believe, has been on this podcast before the war. Obviously, I don't think he would talk to us now, but he speaks great English. He's like a pretty affable guy. And of course, he hosts Putin at Valdai now. And I think he maybe did that before as well. But at any rate, he's like, he didn't leave. He's not opposed to the war in any, you know, public way. And, you know, now he's sanctioned by the EU. I wonder, you know, you're operating there, you're based in Amsterdam. I think that would probably legally bar you from soliciting an op-ed from him. Not that you were...
We pay for op-eds, so, okay, so I believe it would.
There you go. Can't do it. And, you know, maybe you had no interest in it anyway, but like, how does that kind of like legal and political environment affect your work at all?
Never something I've come up against.
Okay. Does it weigh on you in some, you know, philosophical sense that do you feel like suffocated at all by that kind of like political environment? Or do you feel like, well, you know, this is a necessary precaution, or I don't know, something along those lines?
Again, that's just never, I've actually hadn't thought about that until it's brought up, in large part because it's not a situation that has ever presented itself to us.
Okay.
I mean, people who would be arguing a pro-Kremlin position don't tend to read the Moscow Times, and certainly don't pitch me articles. I've found there have been more contested views in that perhaps a similar sense when it comes to countries around Russia's periphery, which we cover to a lesser extent, I think, than Medusa sometimes does. But overall, I mean, I can think of even very few cases where people have written in to argue different things about the United States position towards Russia. I can actually think of one case where somebody wrote in a pitch for me saying that Trump's policy towards Greenland is actually very smart thinking regarding Russia and the Arctic Circle. And, well, I suppose there is a case to be made there, although is fracturing relations with a NATO ally really going to be a very good idea? But there was no case made whatsoever in that article. And there was a slightly disappointing number of puns in there too, which made it impossible to take seriously.
Okay.
Even worse, they were puns in brackets, like breaking the fourth wall with the reader.
Oh dear. Okay. Would you ever, I don't know, I'm not aware of anything along these lines being published, but like, do you have a standing sort of policy of you're not going to publish anything from Russia's, like, you know, Z community? Like, are there like off limits sort of, obviously, like there are off limits things. You wouldn't publish presumably like some racist screed, but what about like, I guess like the reason I ask is not because I'm trying to figure out like what's the worst thing you would publish, but more along the lines of like internally in Russia, their political spectrum is very different, at least when it comes to talking about something like the Ukraine war, for instance. What's considered acceptable and mainstream inside Russia is very different from what you would read in a typical Western news outlet. I mean, you could find expat things that'll be all over the map, certainly. But like, generally speaking, there's they don't overlap. And so,
and you could argue that that's the case with some of the positions of leading Russian opposition figures.
Yeah. Yes, you could. And they're obviously getting a lot more oxygen in the Western media than they ever did in the Russian mainstream media.
And sometimes their views will be mentioned and it's either not contextualized or they'll be recontextualized in a more Western political understanding.
Sure. So how do you manage that? Like, on one hand, you want your readers to understand Russia, right? You're trying to like give them more of a immersive view than they could get in another outlet, because like, we're all in on Russia, we're really going to give you the scoop here. And so with an opinion desk, I imagine the challenge is sort of extreme, because your job is to like cover differences of opinion. And so how do you handle the fact that like their political spectrum, much of it is considered, you know, unacceptable in the West, namely like the Z channels and so on?
I can think of a few examples where we've dealt with that kind of content, but it's been more analytical.
Sure.
Rather than platforming without question.
Yeah.
We don't call the war a special military operation.
Except in scare quotes, maybe, if you're quoting somebody.
Well, if it's within a quote, then we would have to do it. But often I will receive an op-ed and they would include the line, the so-called special military operation, or call it the SMO in scare quotes, and I'll just strike that and write war after that. Yeah. Obviously, we'd handle things differently now that we are undesirable. If the writer was based in Russia, then we would take a different approach to that. But I haven't had to do something like that for quite some time. And that I think, you know, readers should know about the spectrum of what is going on. But I think that's a good example of how things do need to be explained to people. And that if you were just to platform some of these people, it wouldn't be productive. And that I don't think that our reader, who are quite a, I'd say our largest demographic is perhaps late middle-aged men who might enjoy watching a war film at Christmas.
Okay. I'm feeling a little bit attacked, but go ahead.
Don't worry. I know several people like that.
Yeah.
Good. But also we have people with professional backgrounds in Russia, whether that be in the business world or in diplomatic and military circles, but then also people who are just generally slightly interested in what's going on. And when I edit an article, I imagine that my reader is maybe somebody halfway through university or a young professional who is interested in this subject. They might have watched a documentary about whether it be Putin, or they might have watched the Navalny biopic. They might listen to one of the daily Ukraine podcasts, but they haven't spent their life studying this. So some of the most frequent revisions I ask authors to make is, please explain this more simply. Mm-hmm. Or you're assuming an awful lot of context here, which the reader just probably won't have. And that's a particular challenge, actually, when it comes to commissioning or translating op-eds from Russian writers. Obviously, there you have knowledge from within the country and the cultural context, which is fantastic. But they often write as if the reader already has that context. So I have to add it. And if it's translated from our Russian service, which I sometimes do, then it's specifically going to be written for somebody who understands that.
Yeah.
And also, sociologists consider Russia as having a very high context communication culture, whereas in the United Kingdom and the US, we have much lower ones. It's a slightly roundabout way of answering your question, which, yeah, we have to show the dark side, but you have to put it in context and explain it. And I actually think our readers would get a lot more out of that than they would just stumbling across it on Telegram. I have several friends who just have interest in this, but no personal and professional connection with Russia, but they will still read pro-war channels and send me things and ask me what's going on.
Before we close out here, is there one op-ed or analytical piece that you'd like to tell readers to go check out if they want a real sampling of the Moscow Times opinions section?
I suppose one of the things that makes this a difficult question to answer is the diversity within mm-hmm. the section. There was a piece from March of this year that the anthropologist Jeremy Morris wrote, which I think sums up the ethos that I've been trying to describe throughout this conversation. And the headline is, "What is the economy like in Russia? Just ask ordinary people."
Thanks for listening, folks. That's this week's show. As always, check out Meduza's homepage for our reporting on Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. Share this podcast with your friends and enemies if you want. Write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Until next time.